We're talking to Jenny Arnold from the Theodore Payne Foundation. She runs the SEED program. And as I've mentioned a few times, I'm doing this series of talks to get these stories on the record from the various sites spread across LA County. You can see them all indicated on this map. I think most of them are indicated here. But the project is very ephemeral, and it's alive, and it's always changing, and it's spread out in this vast area. So it's very important to me to kind of record this project as much as possible through photographs and stories. So for the last talk, we get to talk to someone from Theodore Payne, and they were the main central catalyst for the project. Land, Los Angeles Nomadic Division, commissioned and produced the project, but it was Theodore Payne that was the critical partner and really the initial inspiration for the project as I was thinking about it. Moving to LA 15 years ago from New York, I started gardening obsessively and then discovered Theodore Payne soon after. And it's one of my favorite places in the city, and it's a place you can go and feel like a sense of what this place might have been like a century ago in terms of the landscape. And Theodore Payne, we can find out more about Theodore Payne from Jenny, but I'll retell this story that I told yesterday, that after I had begun plans to do the project, I read about a similar project that Theodore Payne did over 100 years ago, where he would take walks into the landscape surrounding the city, gather wildflower seeds and create these mixes, and then try to promote them to city residents to get them to plant them on their property here in the city, because he saw this beautiful landscape that was being lost to development. So these mixes in some form are still being sold at Theodore Payne Foundation today, which you can see them here. Anyway, I read these accounts in the book of a book about him that they have at the foundation, where he, over the course of a few seasons, I believe, tried to convince a few owners of vacant lots in Pasadena and Hollywood to plant his seed mixes so that the public could see what this looked like. So Wildflowering LA is really just kind of like a amped up version of that, I suppose, more formalized version of that. Anyway, so when Land first approached me about doing a project and this general idea came to mind, I called Lily Singer at Theodore Payne Foundation. And I called the foundation. She happened to answer that day, and I told her the idea on the phone, and she's like, awesome, and she's really enthusiastic, if you know Lily. And so with that, the project started, because if for whatever reason Theodore Payne Foundation wasn't able to partner on this, we wouldn't have done the project. I mean, they were the key partner who are making these mixes, know what the issues are. And these seed mixes have been now for a century being made in some form or another. So Jenny runs this program. So Jenny, can you tell us a little bit about what you do at the foundation?
Sure. I'm the seed program manager, and what the seed program does is we gather and process native seed, and we clean the seed, we check it for viability, and we store the seed so that the seed is then available to home gardeners, public landscapes, sometimes restoration efforts, to get the native plants out there. And when we collect, we only collect under permit. We never harvest in the wild without a permit. We harvest on our site. We have home gardeners who have native gardens who donate seed to us, should they choose to share their seed. And we also do a program for seed regeneration on site at the foundation, and that's something that follows in Theodore Payne's footsteps, because when he would go harvest the seed in the wild. He would collect small amounts and then do what's called a bulking up process, which is basically propagating those plants and then harvesting the second generation seed to provide to the public so that the wild source is not being overtapped. And so he was ahead of his time and progressive in that method. So we're still carrying on his legacy by doing that practice as well.
So when did he really start the first mixes?
Well, his seed store opened in downtown L.A. In, I believe it was 1905, so that's when it began. And his Theodore Payne's number one, it's the Rainbow Mix, and that is what we changed it a little bit for this project. The Hillside Mix is what that became for this project.
Right.
And that was his original recipe, too.
And the Rainbow Mix is amazing because the other part of my inspiration for this project was my own experience of going to Theodore Payne, experimenting with a few wildflower mixes. And I have a strange house, part of it's underground, and on the roof of my house is my vegetable garden and also this huge patch of dirt that I've never been able to figure out. So a few years ago, I got the Rainbow Mix and I planted that. And I hadn't planted that mix before, and it gets full sun, and it was astonishing. I mean, it was 5.5-6 feet in places, and it was just so glorious. And I had never done anything like that before, I guess, quite. And a lot of my previous gardening projects have been more with edibles. So there was something so delightful about making this landscape that was so beautiful, but also was bringing in all this wildlife that I hadn't seen in my garden before either. So can you talk a little bit about what you see the issues are with native wildflowers in LA right now? In the time that you've been running the program, where you're at with the program? Like, historically, where have we been in a city and our relationship to these kinds of plants, and where are we now?
Sure. Well, I think now is actually a very exciting time for native wildflowers, thanks to efforts like the Wildflowering LA Project, and also a growing interest in removing lawns and replacing the lawns with native landscapes, which a lot of the city departments of water and power are supporting by offering lawn removal rebate programs. And I think that, you know, it's as I said, a very exciting time for wildflowers because more and more people are interested in it for both purposes of water conservation, which, let's face it, saves people money and saves resources, and also to increase urban habitat is a really big one. I feel like people are getting more in tune with being connected to where we live, being proud of being Angelenos and the surrounding landscapes, being interested in what grows here naturally, and learning that, wow, we're going to attract the Sphinx moth if we put in a wildflower garden, which apparently the LA Arboretum had a huge population of the caterpillars as a result of this meadow.
And the Sphinx moths, by the way, we've mentioned them in every single talk, I think. It keeps coming up, and people keep Instagramming pictures of these huge moths, or these huge caterpillars.
Yeah.
And one thing I should mention, too, I guess I haven't fully described this, but we had an open call for 50 sites that were then selected. Theodore Payne Foundation and Jenny mostly gave workshops with people, public workshops that we held, instructing participants how to prepare their sites so the seeds take care of them. And then there was kind of this long winter of responding to emails and like phone calls and people sending pictures of seedlings, like, is that a weed or is that one of the plants and things like that. So, and we have some of the participants here too. So that was a big part of your role in the project, was being the kind of official consultant, because I have a little bit of experience with this, but it was important to have someone who we could refer everyone to provide information. So what was your experience with that, receiving all of those requests for information?
And of course, Lily Singer as well gave a lot of input on kind of guiding people through this process. And it was actually very fun for me to communicate with the participants of the project and kind of walk them through it step by step. And it was also a learning experience for me. I was able, like some folks would send photos. Okay, I have this patch of flowers and there's other things growing up. Which is the weed? What weed is it? Which is the native wildflower? In some cases, I was able to identify the weed right away. In some cases, I knew it was an exotic weed, but I needed to research, pass the picture around to my coworkers and associates who are very knowledgeable. And so I would then learn what the weed was. And also being able to tell people, oh yeah, get that out right now. That's a brome grass or something like that. Get it out before it goes to seed. And knowing that Theodore Payne Foundation was helping this process and helping people understand what to do to make their meadows successful and to minimize the future weed issue on their properties. A lot of the sites did deal with weed growth, and that's normal, it's natural. And you know, there's no time like the present to pull the weeds and go through the process, the gradual process of diminishing that seed bank underneath the soil so that over time the site can become more naturally weed free.
Which is one thing that's really struck me about this project, just my own experience of it, is having for the last 10 years done a series of edible gardens all over the place, where the focus is really on establishing a long-term infrastructure of plants and paths and places for people and trees and shrubs that are going to produce food and annuals mixed within that. It was really interesting to focus on a project exclusively on annuals because it makes you feel like the landscape is even more alive and mutable and constantly changing when you're dealing with a landscape that's exclusively annuals, which isn't necessarily healthy or makes sense, of course, to have a landscape exclusively of annuals. I mean, for this project, you'd have fallow ground for like half the year or something. But there is something kind of beautiful about this sense of these seeds, the seed bank, you know, what's latent in the soil that's waiting to come up. And I know just from gardening on my own land in Glassell Park for the last 15 years, like maniacal weeding for 15 years and then seeding native wildflowers, you can tell over time like fewer and fewer weeds are coming up.
Yes.
And more and more awesome surprises are coming up, you know? So
yes.
Like just for example, I've realized that my garden is now exclusively a garden of volunteers, which means that it's plants that just arrive that I let be there. So I have an entire vegetable garden this season that I did not plant. I laid down a thick layer of compost and I have beans, squash, tomatoes, rocket, like all coming up just from volunteers. And these wildflowers, it's the same thing. There's been... It's such a beautiful metaphor for life, too.
Yes.
And just a way of thinking about the world and our relationship to it, like putting out these seeds that will find, hopefully, places to make themselves at home and come back. But this feeling that these 50 sites across the county, even if they feel like they haven't been successful this season, the thing we keep reminding them of is that well, you weeded this season and you put out these seeds. The seeds are there,
mm-hmm.
you know? So slowly over time, creating an environment where there's more interesting seed bank has been really encouraging.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one thing I love gardening with wildflowers at my own home too, is exactly what you're saying, is kind of the excitement, the anticipation of how your garden is gonna look different every year, the changing of it, and it just makes you feel very connected to and that you're participating in your garden rather than it's this thing that I go out there and do stuff to once a week and then I just let it sit there. It's more like I have a relationship with this land, and I also just wanted to throw in, you mentioned the pollinator issue, which is the native wildflowers attracting pollinators for the edibles. I just kind of want to stress how great they are for that. For example, the lacy phacelia, Phacelia tenacetifolia, it's a wildflower that is known for attracting bees like crazy. And pairing it with an edible garden, it's just such a natural fit because it attracts pollinators. And with my own wildflower meadow at home, I love walking out the front door and it's alive, you know. They don't care about me. I just go do my thing and the insects are doing their thing. But it makes me feel great, like I'm, you know, contributing something in a way, and that I'm participating in something much larger than just me in my front yard. You know, it's, and so the attraction of pollinators is one thing. I did want to kind of just jump onto what you were saying about the benefits of this project.
No, it's huge, and it's something that we saw in all the sites where there was real growth of, and the thing people remarked on the most was wildlife showing up that they'd never seen before, which I know you guys experienced at your place. And I also think that just this difference between planting something and sowing something is really interesting too, because I, as a gardener, there's such pleasure in not deciding where a plant grows, but letting it decide where it's going to be.
Yes.
I kind of love that. For example, there's this urban farmer, I guess you can call him Mud Baron, who runs Muir Ranch over here at Muir School, whatever it's called, the school over here, the public school. And I was over there for a visit doing a talk to the Master Gardening Program, and he gave me a jar this big of mystery seeds. It was his friends who developed seeds, who just all kinds of amazing things. He couldn't even identify what was in there. And he didn't know that that is like my dream thing. It's just a jar of amazing mystery seeds. So now every piece of dirt that I had open in my garden, and I have about 5 sites like that, I just planted this. And it's like my favorite kind of gardening now. I hate planting. I love just that kind of activity. Anyway, so I think maybe this is the best talk to have official questions and answers, since Jenny's the go-to person on wildflower questions. So does anyone have questions?
Yeah. Predators. I assume that bees and butterflies and, you know, caterpillars are not predators, but they're little animals.
Predators for wildflowers, you mean?
Either wildflowers or the edibles, like raccoons, domestic.
Like, what are the enemies of native wildflowers?
Yes,
okay, that's what we want to know.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
go ahead. Go first. I was going to say we had some gopher problems.
Yeah, Fritz is right. I would count them as gophers. And, you know, you hate to paint these little guys as anybody's enemy, but like rabbits sometimes are known to eat. Sometimes deer, especially in a drought season when their wild grazing sites are diminished, they'll even eat like poppies and things they wouldn't normally eat. You know, I haven't personally noticed a lot of evidence of squirrels eating wildflowers, but I suppose if anything was desperate enough, it might. My own wildflower meadow at home, I don't see evidence of anything eating it. I do not have gophers on my site. That is a totally different issue. I don't think there are a lot of natural predators of wildflowers. You know, you might see here and there a leaf or a petal with a couple holes out of it that an insect has consumed. But on the whole, so to speak, I don't see personally a lot of that. You know, I am just speaking from experience.
That's
rabbits.
A good point, though. It's actually, I mean, if you think about all the challenges of growing a vegetable garden, like all the infinite enemies that you have. With the native wildflowers, it seemed like we had very few. I mean, gophers were the main one, especially in a drought season. You know, if there's no water anywhere and then you water a piece of land a lot, the gophers showed up. So I think we had a few sites where they were pretty much devastated by gophers.
Yeah, gophers are tough, and when you're planting perennials with a gopher problem, you know, you can always sink a gopher basket, which is basically like chicken wire fashioned into a basket, and what it does is it surrounds the root ball so that the gophers can't they don't actually kill the plant. They can't pull it down, and it can maintain enough of a root mass to survive. As far as wild seeding, that's different because, you know, you'd have to go for basket an entire area. So gophers can be tricky. Can I just insert one thing really quickly about this year, as we know, was a drought issue. And so the sites did have to apply a little more water than we originally predicted. But I did just want to add one more benefit of wildflowers is that as the years go on, so the participants had to water their meadow this first year. As the years go on, those wildflowers are going to come back with less or maybe even no additional water. They can naturalize. And so, you know, next year if we get a little more rain, folks might not even have to add more water, and they'll get some of the wildflowers coming back on their own. So that's another benefit to wildflowers, is their ability to adapt.
But I don't understand that part, because aren't they just sprouting, germinating again from seed, just the same as the first time?
They are, but the way I like to explain it is this. Sometimes people will see a wildflower growing in a wild setting and say, it's all over the hillside, why can't I get it to grow in my yard? And my answer to that is that it's always different when you're growing in what I call captivity, or, you know, a horticultural setting where you're a person is trying to germinate the seed rather than the effects of the natural world. And there is a lot of mystery to it. There are a lot of factors, unknown factors, that affect the germination, from chemicals in the soil to responses to weather events to maybe the presence of wild animals that are transferring the seed from place to place, that, you know, we can't trace all those. We can't trace reasons for everything to a specific event when we're trying to recreate this in our own yards. Wildflowers have a way of naturalizing, where they sort of adapt that mystery in our own yard. And I know from experience, because I sowed a Phacelia minor, a really pretty blue Phacelia, which is local in our LA chaparral, 2 years in a row. And so I got just a couple, and I wanted more. But by the third year, they came up on their own. And that was this year, and I didn't apply any extra water. So they just have a way of naturalizing.
Mm-hmm. No, the Phacelia in particular is what's naturalized in my garden.
Yeah.
Because I have an area where that's coming back every year, and actually coming back quite early. So mine was up, you know, before we, you know, we... It was like a much earlier cycle than the wildflower project was.
Yeah, yes. It's...
Any other
anyway.
Questions? Yeah.
First of all, how do you distinguish wildflower and
weed? Well, a weed...
Do you mean when they're just first sprouting? Like, how do you identify them? Or what's a weed? And you mean, like...
Okay, I've wondered that. I've wanted a technical definition of that myself before, so I actually did some research. The technical definition of a weed is any plant that's unwanted in a specific area. To us, in this context, the difference is a wildflower is something that's native to California that grows here, does occur here naturally, and a weed is something that is exotic or came in from somewhere else over time. And also, the trait of a weed is not just that it's from somewhere else, but that it tends to overtake the environment, because it uses up the resource that the native wildflowers also need, such as the what little rainfall we had this year, for example, so that they outcompete the wildflowers. And I also don't think that they attract the same level of pollinators that the native wildflowers do. A lot of insects in California exclusively eat native plants. So the other difference would be that the weeds are not providing the habitat that the native wildflowers are.
My definition of a weed is that it takes more than it gives.
That's great.
And I'm like, I love weeding. It's my favorite thing. And I really decide what to take out and what to keep. And there's a lot of things that come up that some people would think of as a weed, maybe that, you know, like I know what my rocket looks like, my, you know, my leafy greens, my lettuces, my arugulas, like, because I let everything bolt a lot of times if I'm lazy, I'm not eating it, which means it's setting seed and flowering and stuff, because it reseeds like crazy. And when I see that coming up, I get really excited, and some people might weed it, but to me that's you know, I love that distinguishing between those two.
Yeah, I worked on site 47, and I was just curious during the process of kind of getting things going and getting a consultation with Lily, I was told not to put down mulch, and I felt going through the process that would have really helped a lot in terms of keeping the weeds down, keeping moisture in the soil, not having water as much, keeping water from not migrating off and onto the sidewalks and things like that. And you know, in our own house, we installed wildflowers a couple years ago, and she mulched and just sowed the seeds right on top of the mulch and watered one time, and it was beautiful that whole year. So I'm just curious, why not mulch through this process?
Mulch versus not mulch. I think for this project, the reason that we encouraged to do it without mulch is because you can seed with mulch, but you have to be very careful about how you do it. Because a lot of times I'll talk to people, they'll say, I sowed so many poppies and then I put mulch down and nothing came up. What happened? And what it is that you have to do a thin layer of mulch, what I call a single layer, whether you're using gravel or a bark mulch. And by that, I really just mean like one piece of the material, the pieces right next to each other, because the seed does need light and air to come up. So if too much mulch is put down, that can be an issue because it buries the seed. And then that's
oh,
the
like
other
a really
thing.
Coarse mulch and then throw it on
I
top.
Just threw it right
oh
on top
yeah,
of
that's
the
really
mulch,
smart.
Mulch, like 3 inches deep.
And what?
Sewed it on top.
Oh.
What was in that mulch that you put down?
It was not very good mulch. It was free mulch from the city, which has eucalyptus and all that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, I've heard different things, different stories from different people. I've heard, you know, something similar to what your experience was, and that's great. And I've also heard people say, oh, I put down gorilla hair mulch, which is like a shredded mulch, or I put down steer manure mulch, and it didn't work. In those settings, certain types of mulch, actually the mulch itself dries out really fast, even though it's still serving to keep the soil underneath retaining water, so that you'd have to really keep at it a lot to give it enough moisture to have the seed germinate. But, you know, I've also talked to people with stories like yours who said, hey, I basically just threw this stuff down and it worked. We just base our guidance on what we know from our experience. I think if you do a single layer of a particle mulch, like a gravel or wood bark, you can drizzle the seed in between and just water it. And it does help to keep weeds down and to retain moisture. So, you know, and that's one of the interesting things about horticulture is there are no hard and fast rules, and you can talk to 20 different people, and each of those people is going to have different theories about why they suggest doing things the way they do. A lot of it is trial and error, as Fritz knows, and that's part of the fun of it. So, you know, I've heard both success stories with mulch like yours, and that's great. And I've heard stories where it didn't work out so well either. So.
And also what you were talking about on your site of how varieties of things attracted to different areas. If you go to the Arboretum now, where the biggest site is, it's one almost an acre. We did hugel mounds, we did swales, we did a lot of topography. We removed Bermuda grass there that's been rolled up and is inside some of the mounds. I mean, it's a really like wide variety of situations there. And we planted the roadside mix or the flats mix, I forget.
Flatlands.
Was the flatlands, yeah. It's so bizarre the way things have gone there, because the hugel mounds are full exclusively of California poppies, the south one, which is so bizarre, because I thought they didn't like fertile soil. And then there's one area where it's just lupin. For some reason, it's like clumped in these certain areas. And then tidy tips are these long, flat areas, just endless tidy tips. And then the perimeters and are like tons of clarkias, It's just, there's a lot, it's like there's an even mix that's been spread out.
Yeah.
But you would never know it from what's happened on that site. It's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. Every site has such different soil issues as far as what's inside the soil type. So where mulch might work for some people, maybe with somebody with hard pan clay, unless that's what you have.
Not the greatest soil.
But, you know, if somebody has really heavy clay, you know, maybe certain kinds of mulch wouldn't be a good match for that. So it just depends on the site. And, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder if it's possible to do a cluster like this, incorporating native edible plants. I feel like there's a lot of urban gardeners already. You can kind of tap into, a whole new audience, personally interested.
He was, well, it's good for the recording too. He was asking about the possibility for native edible gardens, since that kind of is, in a way, a fusion of the two, this idea of native plants are using less water that are, you know, naturally occurring here, and also productive edible gardens. I mean, I can say that, if you're going to do that, what you really end up doing is going back to look at how people lived on this land centuries ago. And there's a wonderful book called Tending the Wild by M. Kat Anderson that's a beautiful account of how the 100 Native Nations of California lived on this land before European settlers lived here. And European settlers arrived thinking it was wild and that the natives were lazy and just living high off the land. And what they didn't realize was a highly tended landscape that was more fertile, more diverse, more beautiful than if people hadn't been tending it. And they didn't have a word for wild, and when they got the word wild, for them it was very negative, it meant uncared for. So if you look at native edibles, what you're really looking at is, well, how did the native Californians live off the land? And they did, obviously, but it's a different diet, you know, and it's a different processing of the fruits and the, you know, there's not like tomatoes or, you know, things we're
kale.
Basing a lot. Yeah, kale. There's no native kale.
There's no kale.
Yeah, a whole like percentage of our diet would go out the door. So, yeah, I mean, it would be a substantial reconsideration of just diet, I think. I mean, this is not something I've really investigated that much, but you're looking at a very different relationship to food.
Yeah, and one thing I would recommend to you is that if you have an edible garden with things like tomatoes and kale, you keep that. And what you can do is select a few native species that do provide fruits, or you can eat the leaves or use them for tea, and add those to your garden. The yerba buena, you can make, it's a mint, you can make tea out of it. There's the chia, which is an annual wildflower, which the seeds are edible. And yes, our native California chia is also edible, just like the ones you buy in the store. You know, you can add currant bushes where you can eat the berries. So I like to suggest to people like a fusion edible garden. Little bit of both.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, my projects have been very focused, like laser focused on particular approaches. So you could do an exclusively native edible garden or landscape, I'm sure. But I think ultimately what we're talking about for like a typical homeowner would be a real diverse mix of, if you're broadcasting native wildflower seeds, those are coming up amidst everything else and attracting pollinators, while you're planting cultivars that are like more familiar, and then native species that are producing other kind of fruits that are less familiar, and they're all together.
Yeah, and I hope it's okay if I add, we do offer classes on native edibles at the Theodore Payne Foundation. I think we offer the class about 3 times a year, where you can learn which plants are edible. Some of them, as Fritz was saying, do some of the fruits, like the toyon berry is edible. Please don't go up to a toyon in Griffith Park and put the berry in your mouth. It requires some preparation. But the classes will tell you how to do those things. And it also ties into the book that Fritz mentioned, Living Wild, Wild has some recipes and things. So the native edibles, it's just kind of a learning process in how to, which ones are edible and how to get them from being on the plant to being on your plate.
Yeah.
Can you give me that name again? Tending the Wild?
Tending the Wild.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Wrong book.
M. Cat Anderson.
I'm sorry, who was it again?
M. Cat, K-A-T, Anderson. It's a great book.
And there's also, there is a book called Living Wild with recipes in it, and I'm forgetting the author right now. I'm sorry about that. But there are several book resources on that topic.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Jenny.
Thank you.
Twice the time I said it would take, but.
I talk a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, friends.